From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. What a program in store for you tonight. By the way, happy birthday, 87 years old, Al Truchin down there in Southern California, an avid listener of Coast to Coast AM. And Al, you know, you gave us the greatest present we could ever get, your daughter, Lisa Lyon, our executive producer. So thank you and happy birthday, Al. Here's what's happening. Idaho has set the example of other states to follow in the continuing revolt against naked body scanners by passing a law that limits the use of the X-ray scanning devices in airports and government buildings and also forces Homeland Security to disprove health concerns. State Representative Phil Hart in Idaho says that he has passed a bill that will limit the use of the scanners to people who have failed a prior security check, such as a metal detector. Well, get ready for this one. Cash-strapped cities and states consider measures ranging from expansion of red light camera systems that we've talked about here on Coast to Coast to charging you for cleanup if you get into an accident. They want money. They need money. And motorists can only expect more of the same as cash-strapped cities and states consider measures ranging from all of these. In Iowa, for example, lawmakers are battling over shortfalls in the state's public safety budget. They're exploring ways to increase fines for traffic violations. There's a proposal in Maryland to add $7.50 to traffic fines just to help pay for law enforcement and police protection equipment. Cash-strapped California is seeing some of the most aggressive efforts to squeeze money out of motorists, raising the price for vehicle licensing fees. It's going to get worse. President Barack Obama preparing to sign a transformation health care bill, ushering a near universal medical coverage for the first time in the nation's history. And then he will hit the road to sell it to a somewhat reluctant public. President Obama will travel to Iowa City, Iowa on Thursday, as he now turns to seeing a companion bill through the Senate and selling the health care overhaul's benefits on behalf of House members who cast risky votes. In the last hour of the program tonight, Greg Hunter is going to join us, former ABC newsman. We are going to talk about this health bill and how it affects you, how it will cost you money if you already have health insurance, and what it means to you if you don't. Last hour on Coast to Coast AM. In New York, a new poll reports that half of New York voters support legalizing the use of marijuana for medical purposes. The Siena Research Institute shows that 50% back legalization, while 41% are opposed, and 9% simply say they don't have enough information. Now, Chris Conrad is a court-qualified expert on cannabis. He's also the curator of the Hash Marijuana Hemp Museum in Amsterdam. Chris, I would have thought that percent would have been higher. 50% backed the legislation. I would have thought it would have been 60 or 70%. How about you?
Well, yeah, it is. It's a statistical anomaly, considering that just in February, a national poll by ABC and the Washington Post found 80% support. So when you see that kind of a dip, there's always a question about if there's some bias in the wording or what might have happened there. But anyway, you look at it, only 41% support the current ban on medical marijuana, even if this number does turn out to be fairly accurate. And, you know, it only takes 50% plus one to elect a president. So I would say that it's still part of this trend nationally to support more personal freedom in this area. And when you look at California, you've got 56% for legalizing marijuana completely for adult use. So, you know, the movement is going, this is counter to the current movement, I would say.
What did your crystal ball show you about the next 5-10 years with this issue, Chris?
Well, what we've seen here in California is that when people become more comfortable with medical marijuana, they become more comfortable with the idea of just regulating adult use. And so I see the movement as continuing to move towards continuing softening of these laws around the country. As far as the federal government is concerned, you know, it only takes one presidential signature to change the whole thing. And Obama has put actually together some interesting points in terms of telling government agencies to rely upon scientific factual bases and to respect states' rights. And then specifically on the medical marijuana issue, we saw him come out saying that they should not prioritize raids. And so, you know, this is a president who he could surprise us still, but most people aren't expecting that to happen on the federal level anytime soon.
All right, Chris's website is part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com, chrisconrad.com. A Chicago schoolgirl is facing surgery on both wrists after sending more than 100 text messages a day from her mobile phone. Annie Levitt, she's 16 years old, who has lost the feeling in her hands, is unable to pick up some objects now, has to wear braces on both wrists, and also needs pain-killing injections. Doctors say she is suffering from carpal tunnel syndrome, whereby nerves in the wrist become trapped. The condition is usually associated with frequent computer keyboard use. Annie insisted she has cut down on her texting habit, but only down to 50 a day. Now, here's one of the most unbelievable stories you'll ever hear. When Crockett Lacey went into cardiac arrest, he was lucky to have his brother Ronnie nearby. Then Ronnie had his own heart attack. Both men taken to a Poplar Bluff, Missouri hospital emergency room. Both of their hearts had stopped virtually simultaneously. Both were saved. Doctors are still amazed at what they say is a coincidence. No, we don't believe in that, of two brothers going code blue at the very same time. Airport bosses in Rio de Janeiro have come up with a solution to potentially deadly collisions between planes and birds. They have created a robot hawk. The Roboraptor is being tested near the airports to see if it can scare away flocks responsible for bird strikes, according to the company that manages airports in Brazil. In the last 2 years, bird strikes increased by 45%. The collisions can cause damage to engines and other parts of planes, causing emergency landings, even severe fatal crashes. A long time ago in a far-off land, when I was very, very young, my mother came home with a book. It was called We Are Not Alone. It was written by the then New York Times science writer Walter Sullivan. It was a fascinating book about the possibility of life out there. I was hooked ever since. Helped drive me into programs like Coast to Coast. In a moment, David Darling joins us, British astronomer, with his latest work, We Are Not Alone, Why We Have Already Found Extraterrestrial Life. David's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. David Darling, British astronomer, regular here on Coast to Coast AM, PhD from the University of Manchester in England. He's the author of a number of books on subjects ranging from life in the universe to life after death. And he's got a great one now. The latest, We Are Not Alone, Why We Already Found Extraterrestrial Life. And by the way, his website, The Words of David Darling, tackles everything from silicon-based life to UFOs. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. David, my friend, how are you?
I'm very well, George. How are you doing?
Good to have you back with us. How are things going in the UK these days?
Oh, they're ticking along,
Wow.
Yep, watching events over the pond too. It's interesting.
I'm telling you,
interesting times.
Many times, David. Many, and at least thank God for science, huh?
Well, at least you know where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a long time ago, I was talking about this book that my mother had given me by
Sure.
Walter Sullivan called "We Are Not Alone."
Absolutely.
And you've taken it a step farther. In those days, Walter, as a science writer, didn't have the kind of information that we're getting today. It's remarkable what could be out there, David, isn't it?
Well, you know, and we consciously borrowed Walter's title because, as you mentioned in your introduction there, it was a hugely influential book, and it affected me and got me going into science. And, of course, he was talking about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which had just begun back in the 60s. I think his book came out in about 66, so I would have been in my early teens then, and the most influential age, you know. And it just, it was a visionary book, I mean, well ahead of its time. But the science of astrobiology, the actual search for life on other planets, was really in its infancy in those days. And he was talking about even going beyond that, you know, looking for signals from worlds going around other stars, which we're still doing, of course. But we borrowed that title and we stuck on the subtitle, Why We Have Already Found Extraterrestrial Life. And our claim And I should say, when I say we, because this is the first book I've actually co-authored, and it's co-authored with an astrobiologist, an active professional scientist at Washington State University called Dirk Schulz-Makuch, who I'm good friends with. But he is a young and up-and-coming astrobiologist. He's written many papers on life on Mars and Venus and Titan. It's good to have him on board because he kind of puts the scientific stamp of approval on a book that I believe every word of, but it's nice to have an active scientist with me as a co-author. But we're cutting through all the nonsense, and we're saying we have already found proof of extraterrestrial life based on the Viking mission, which is now 34 years old, and other information that's come since from Mars meteorites and methane discoveries on Mars. And we think that we've got conclusive proof of that, and that's the case that we're making in our new book.
You know what's amazing? As you said, the Viking, at 36 years, can you believe that, Dave?
I know. It's just incredible, isn't it? It seems like yesterday, just like the Apollo missions do. You know, they're so alive in your memory.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a generation or more ago. It is incredible. But the thing about the Viking is that we found life through Viking. And in a sense, and I kind of believe, it may be a strong way to put it, but I think the public was actually misled about the results that came from Viking. The scientific mainstream from that was that Viking didn't find life. The things that it did find, you could put down to active chemicals in the soil. But when you go through those results, and also you look at that findings that have come to light since about faulty instrumentation on which that scientific claim was made, you realize that actually the signals that Viking did pick up pointed very, very, very strongly to organisms in the Martian soil. And that's a key point that we make in the book.
That's exciting. And, you know, with this universe as vast as it is, and we'll talk about that later on, David, there have got to be hundreds and thousands of Earth-like planets out there, don't you think? Just by probability.
Yeah. We're already finding them. Because we've got this new Kepler space probe, which is now specifically looking for Earth-like planets around the stars. And as our instruments get more sensitive and our techniques get more sophisticated, we are discovering smaller and smaller, in other words, more Earth-like, rocky-type planets around other stars. We already know about 500 now planets going around other stars. It's absolutely staggering. That's within just about the last decade or so, we've discovered 500 planets. And the rate of discovery is increasing all the time. So within another decade, I am sure we'll have a catalog of hundreds, if not thousands, of Earth-like planets. And then we can start to look at those promising worlds for signs of life. And that's when the whole field is going to blow wide open.
What do you think of this, what I call, David, the primordial soup in the universe, where everything does seem to be the same? The elements generally are the same on all the planets.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just all there. And it just seems to have so much order to it. Solar systems are the same. They all create themselves the same. The stars, you know, do their thing. Why is it so orderly?
Well, this gets to maybe this is something we can come back to later on as well. But this is a key question now that the scientists as well as ordinary folk are starting to wonder about is also why is the universe so creative? You know, you go back.
Oh yeah.
You know, you go back 13, 14 billion years ago to the supposed Big Bang when everything was chaotic and, you know, you've got this massive explosion and you've got just got energy and matter and it would just look like a bomb going off, basically, you know, in a simple-minded way. And yet 14 billion years later, it's organized itself into galaxies and stars and planets and dogs and human beings. And all the rest of it that we see, you look around you, and you would never, ever, if you had been a fly on the wall in those days,
oh my God,
could you imagine that it would have resulted in this? Now, whatever interpretation you put on that, there's some sort of information or code built into the universe. Whatever you want to believe is behind that.
Yes. You want to say intelligence, I know it.
you want to say there's some guiding principle that, you know, there's no way, there is no way that if you set off a bomb, that 14 billion years later, it's going to organize itself into what we've got around us today. You know, that is that there is something innate in the universe that directs it towards creativity. I agree with you. I don't know myself what's behind that. You can call it what you want, but label. But, you know, the fact is it's incredible what has happened.
You know what
some scientists say? They say, well, okay, there's more than one universe, okay?
Exactly.
There's not two, there's not three, there's almost an infinite number. There's trillions and trillions and trillions of universes. And in those that don't produce order and complexity in life, there's nobody around to ask the question. But in the ones where life appears, people start wondering, hey, something funny is going on here, you know. So you can go that route as well. But, you know, it's a huge question at the moment.
You know, I'm in the Midwest right now, and I was driving today by a golf course, and I saw people out there, you know, golfing away. I used to golf years ago when I was younger, but it takes up so much time. I don't have that kind of time anymore. But they're out there. They're having a great time. And as I'm driving past these people, David, I'm saying to myself, the old question, what's it all about? Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I started thinking about people who were cave dwellers, and you know, back thousands and thousands of years. And they didn't have golf courses. They didn't do this. They didn't have television. They didn't have computers. Their day-to-day existence was waking up, going to eat, going to get food, and procreating, coming back home. And that was it. That was their life.
Mm-hmm.
And as I thought about what it would be like to be a cave dweller, at any point did they say to themselves, what am I here for? And if they had any kind of intelligence at all, don't you think they would have asked themselves that question, even at that primitive stage?
I think they would. And the thing is that, you know, even if you're talking about tens of thousands of years ago, and those people are just as smart as we were. You know, you go back.
Oh yeah.
You go back 40,000, even 100,000 years ago. Those creatures that we still call them human. They had the same brain capacity. You raise one of their children in a school today, and they would turn out just perfectly normal. You know, they would look like the rest of us. You know, so they had that capability, and they would, you know, they would gather at the mouth of their caves at night, and they'd look up at the stars. They weren't stupid. You know, they didn't know what they were looking at, but they would look at those points of light in the sky and they would wonder about it. You know, I'm reminded of the film 2001, A Space Odyssey, a scientific classic, where those, and that's going back even further in time because they were then, you know, ape men rather more than human. But they wondered about things. They were curious. They would ask questions. And there's no doubt about that. There's no doubt about that. They would interpret things in a different way than we do today, obviously, based on what they knew. But they would wonder. They were curious. That's the innate human drive is to wonder, to explore, to ask, what on earth is it all about? You know, that's who we are.
Can you imagine how far we've come in the last 100 and 150 years?
I know.
Dramatic.
I know. You know, flight. When did that start? 1908, I'm not very good at my history,
right,
but you know,
that.
The Wright brothers, 1908, that's just over 100 years ago. I think we celebrated this, the centennial of that a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And now we've got probes heading out of the solar system. We've got five spacecraft now that are bound on courses that will lead them to the stars. 100 years after we first, you know, had powered flight. That is spectacular.
40 years ago, we were on the moon. That was 24 years after World War II. Whoever would have imagined that?
Exactly, exactly. You know, and we are capable of so much more, you know. We get, you get finances and politics and all the rest of it get in the way, but we have the capability to go to the stars, to explore the universe as a whole. And our minds somehow seem to be tuned into that. You know, as going back to what we were saying before, you know, these cave people that lived thousands of years ago, you raise one of their kids in a regular school today, they'd be capable of math, they'd be capable of going on to do physics and relativity and all the rest of it, you know?
That's true.
Why is it that our brains are so capable of such a thing? Why do you need to be able to do calculus and relativity and quantum mechanics if you're just bent on survival? Why is it our brains are already keyed into that kind of thing? That's a question that fascinates me.
I wonder if the cave baby, though, would eat the pet dog or something in a school.
Well, it would be tempting, wouldn't it? Yeah,
it would be. But you're right. It's if you put them in this environment, they would be able to possess the things we can teach
they'd
them.
They'd be the same as us. Exactly. That's right. And which is incredible. Why is that? You know, why are our brains so attuned to the universe as a whole? Well, we came from the universe, really. You know, I mean, every atom of our being is made from stuff that has been recycled through stars. That's the only way that elements like carbon, which is the basis of life, is created.
It's all over the place, David. Hey, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back. This show's going faster than a rocket ship. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And our very special guest tonight, David Darling, his work, We Are Not Alone. And we'll be back with David in just a second on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with astronomer David Darling with us. We're talking about his latest work, We Are Not Alone. David, what's going on in the world of astronomy? New techniques, new equipment, making things even more marvelous?
Yeah, both on the ground and in space, we're rolling right along with instruments that can take us further back into the universe. Because of course, the further we look back in space, the further we look back in time. So we're seeing things close to the beginning of everything, and at the same time, we're looking for, as we've already talked about, new planets around other stars. A huge amount of information coming in. It's almost too much information to process, really. That's the problem right now. We're being overwhelmed by the amount of new information that's coming in, and these giant telescopes that are being in the process of being built that are going to extend our vision even more. These are very, very exciting times.
Scientists last week reported that deep under Antarctica, they spotted other species of fish. Mm. They had no idea what these creatures could have been. They didn't think they existed. Mm. That tells me that some of these planets that might not be as close to their sun as we are to ours, maybe there is some other life there too.
We've got to be imaginative and extend our net further, because, of course, we only know about one example of life, you know, the familiar life that we see around us. But even so, we're becoming aware of creatures that can exist in extreme environments, you know, these hot hydrothermal vents at the bottom of oceans where it's completely dark and the only energy available is chemical energy coming from the stuff that's pouring out of these cracks in the seabed. And you know, and we're also finding places further out in the solar system, like these moons of Jupiter and Saturn, which appear to be frozen. You know, years ago, nobody would have given a second glance. They would have looked, said, well, these are just cold balls of rock. Now we're discovering that they might have underground oceans heated by tidal heating, gravitational heating, which could well have life in them. You know, wherever you've got a lot of water and you've got a source of energy, you've got to think, well, there could be life in them. So we have to be more creative in our thinking. Life isn't just going to be like the sort of familiar things we see around us. There could be even more examples of unfamiliar life right here on our own planet, let alone way out in space. So life could take many forms, both simple and advanced. Yeah,
absolutely. What's your take on Phobos? Mars is one of its moons, where astronomers weren't quite so sure what that thing was.
Yeah. You know, way back, and this is going back again to the Walter Sullivan era, back in the '60s. There was some discussion about the moons of Mars being artificial because they're unusual in the way they move. They're very, very close to Mars, for one thing. They're the closest moons to a planet that we know of. They're just a few thousand or tens of thousands of miles up. You know, they're just little balls of rocks. There's two of them, Phobos and Deimos. One's about 5 or so miles across. The other's about 10, 15 miles across. They're little chunks of rock, probably captured asteroids, but you see them close up, and they've got some unusual features on them. Phobos, for instance, has got some strange grooves running across its surface and a giant crater. They're interesting objects. We don't know a whole lot about them, but they're quite unlike our own moon when you look at them visually.
Would you be in shock if we found out that it was artificial, at least one of them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Everybody would be in shock. You know, you hear talk about this, there's speculation about, and I'm quite open to some of these things. I'm not sure.
You are.
I'm not sure about Phobos and Deimos. To me, they look like asteroids when you look at them. But, you know, talk about artificial structures on Mars, for example. Now, I can build a scientific picture for you that leads from, as I was talking about before, our book begins with virtual proof that Viking and subsequent information has found simple life forms on Mars, okay?
Yeah.
Now, you can start from that. And you can build a picture of how advanced life could come about on Mars. Now, I'm not going to carry everybody through with that argument, maybe not a lot of mainstream scientists, but you can certainly make a case that if life got started on Mars, as I firmly believe it did, and it still exists there today, that Mars may well have developed complex life, in other words, something equivalent to our animals and plants, very, very early on. Now, it happened late on Earth. It took a long time to go from, say, bacteria to, you know, kangaroos and human beings on Earth. It took billions of years. And part of the reason for that is you need an oxygen-rich atmosphere for the kind of advanced life we have here on Earth. Now, the reason that we didn't get oxygen early on Earth is because of plate tectonics. You get this recycling of oxygen, which takes it away from the atmosphere and buries it back into the rocks again. Now, on Mars, there isn't such a recycling process. There is no plate tectonics, no movement of the crust. So any oxygen that was produced early on could have remained in the atmosphere. Now, if you had an early oxygen-rich atmosphere on Mars, say within 100 million years of the first life appearing, it could have accelerated the process to advanced and complex life very early on, hundreds of times faster than it did on Earth. So there is a reason to believe that maybe complex life developed on Mars long, long time ago, maybe 3.5 billion years ago. What happened to it subsequently, we don't know. But, you know, people look at features on Mars and they say, hey, that looks like a face, that looks like pyramids,
yeah,
you know, things right. like that. You know, and on the surface they say, oh, that looks a little bit like a skull. Some of these things I don't buy at all. You know, if I see something that looks like a skull, I think, ah, that's just a rock that looks like a skull. It's not necessarily a skull. You don't jump right to that conclusion. But you've got to look at some of these things and you think, boy, those do look like a group of pyramids, you know.
Well, when you look at it in its entirety, David, then you have to come up with some of those conclusions.
You've got to consider them and not dismiss them out of hand, as many scientists do. Because, you know, just because something doesn't fit within your comfortable worldview doesn't mean that it's not worth looking at, you know. So people, and as I said before, there's so much information coming in, so many pictures from space probes. And we've got a whole slew of spacecraft either on the surface or going around Mars that are sending back millions, literally millions of images. There's no way that conventional scientists can look through every detail of these and look for, you know, interesting anomalies. But, you know, folk at home who, you know, pull up these raw images, they can do that. And you don't dismiss what they say. You know, you've got to look at them carefully. And I've looked at some of these images, and I've read a book by Mark Carlotto, you may have heard of. He's an image processing specialist. He has a PhD in the subject, for goodness sake. And he's written a book called The Cydonia Controversy, which he was good enough to send me. And I've been very, very impressed by what he's written about. And I look at some of these things, and I think, well, we don't want an astrobiologist on the ground there. We want an astroarchaeologist. We want somebody who understands ancient buildings. Maybe there is evidence there, you know, and if there was a civilization 3.5 billion years ago, you would expect to find some sort of remains still there on Mars. I don't dismiss those sort of things at all. I think it's a perfectly reasonable scientific thread of evidence that leads you to that sort of speculation. I have no problem with that at all.
Is it possible that the Martians are us, that they came here somehow?
Well, you know, there's a good chance that life developed on Mars even before it did on Earth, because the conditions on Mars, going back 4 billion years to when the planet had just cooled, and we know there was water, a lot of water on Mars in those days. There were oceans on Mars. We know it was warmer. We know it had a denser atmosphere. It was actually a more benign place for life in those long ago ages than the Earth was. So if life appeared here on Earth, why didn't it also appear even earlier, perhaps, on Mars? And we also know a means that life can be conveyed from one world to another, and that is by meteorites. We've got chunks of Mars here on Earth. We've got 70 chunks of rock that we know came from Mars. Now, they could have carried bacteria from Mars, which could have then evolved on Earth. Or, going back to my original idea that maybe advanced Martians developed, okay, how about this? How about if 3.5 billion years ago or thereabouts, there were actually intelligent Martians, and they looked ahead and they realized their planet was dying. It was going to get colder, it was going to get drier. Hey, we've got to get out of here.
Yeah,
you know?
They knew.
What are their options? They can go underground, which is very time-consuming. It's not too great to live under the surface. We could go to other stars. Well, okay, if they have the technology, you could do that. No reason why not. Or you look at this other nice planet that's nearby and say, well, okay, we'll hop over there, you know? So there's those three possibilities. So, yeah. We could be related to Martians. Yeah, absolutely.
If life evolved on planet Earth with the smallest organism, is it conceivable to assume that if that same small organism were on a different planet, under similar circumstances, would life evolve almost the same way? Would we get the fishes and the mammals and the human beings?
Well, I don't think you would in detail. You know, there's just too many twists and turns in the tale of how things develop. And if you look at certain periods on Earth, you know, go back about 500 million years, which isn't too long. I mean, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. So we'll go back 500 million years. There's something called a Cambrian explosion, which is when all these new, it's like suddenly nature was experimenting with all these new kinds of life. Most of which didn't make it, you know, they just weren't equipped for survival. It was like throwing, well, let's see what we can do now, you know, like an artist who just tries something out and say, oh, that's no good, you know, that's not going to work. And occasionally something does work and it survives. And you look among the fossils in the so-called Cambrian explosion, you see all the weirdest things, you know, creatures that have strange number of legs and antennae sprouting in all directions. And most of these things, you look later on, they've disappeared. They just didn't survive for very long. Now, in another rerun of the Earth or in another world, some of those things would have survived if conditions had been right. Now, you know, life adapts to whatever it finds around itself. So, you know, for example, on Mars, creatures that developed very early on, and I believe they're still there today, some of them, are going to adapt to whatever, you know, in the case of Mars, it got a lot colder, it got a lot drier. So what if you're going to be on the surface, you've got to be able to survive those sort of harsh conditions, or you'd bury yourself underground and survive there. If you're on Europa, which is one of the moons of Jupiter, and all you've got is this huge ocean beneath the surface, you've got to live in eternal darkness and somehow get your energy from the water or stuff that's coming up from the seabed or stuff that's filtering down through the rock from the surface. You've got to adapt in different ways. And who knows that even that life somewhere else is even based on carbon. Maybe it's based on silicon. Maybe it can be based on pure radiation. We don't know the limits of life. So our little example here is no indication of how diverse life could be elsewhere. At the same time, there could be constraining factors. You know, some people say, well, yeah, there are probably other humans somewhere else. Maybe it's good to have hands that can grasp things, maybe a pair of eyes that can give you binocular vision, and a single brain somewhere protected inside a bony skull. You don't want your brain hanging out somewhere where it can get bashed around by everything that you bump into. You need it protected. You know, you need somewhere to take air in. You need some form of locomotion. So there are basic things that are going to be the same, you know. Silicon-based fish might still have fins because that's a good way of moving through a liquid. So, yeah, you've got these two different factors at work, things that, are, you know, where nature experiments with different life forms and the basic laws of physics, which say, well, this is the best way of surviving.
What would a silicon-based human being look like on another planet?
Very, very difficult to say. I mean, you know, silicon is an element that is similar chemically to carbon in many ways. And, you know, carbon is the basis of all life that we know here on Earth.
Yeah.
But silicon, if you look at the way chemicals are arranged, it's very similar in the way it can form big molecules. Now, You know, does it mean because a life form is based on silicon that it has to be different in its appearance? We don't know. The sort of conditions you'd expect silicon to be good at would be more high temperature environment. So what sort of creatures would you get in a high temperature environment? It's hard to say. It's hard to speculate. You're almost getting into Star Trek territory there. You know, they talked about a few silicon-based life forms in Star Trek, but it's getting into the realm where, you know, yeah, anything goes. Whatever you choose to speculate could happen out there. And what we need now is actual data that tells us what is going on.
In our solar system, when the planets all formed, did they all form at about the same time?
Well, we believe so. You know, within a few million years, this is I can only give you the scientist view on this. To begin with, the solar system consisted of a big cloud of gas and dust, and then the sun formed at the center of it, pulled in most of that matter and formed into a star. And then what you ended up with is a sort of pancake of gas and dust going around it, which then consolidated into the planets. And, you know, within a few million years, the idea is that they all formed more or less at the same time. Yeah.
What keeps the rotation for all those objects, or even the dust when it was forming?
Well, whatever gravity and whatever rotation you start out with is what you end up with. There's no way of increasing it or decreasing the overall rotation rate. So it's kind of like, if you imagine, it's, as far as spinning goes, imagine an ice skater, okay?
All right.
And to begin with, you know, she's got her arms stretched out way out from her body, mm-hmm. and then as she pulls them in, she spins faster and faster and faster. You know, she's going faster, but her overall momentum stays the same, because if she puts her arms back out again, she'll slow back down to the rate she had to begin with.
Right.
And it's the same with the planets. You know, you start out with an interstellar cloud of gas and dust that is rotating very slowly just through random motion, and then as it pulls itself in through gravity, so it spins faster and faster. And it happens with individual planets as well. They pull in gas and dust, and they end up with a small rotation which gets faster as it pulls itself in. And then once it's got that rotation, it's going to keep it. There's nothing that's going to slow the Earth down. There's no friction, you know. So the Earth is going to keep on spinning more or less as it does now for the rest of time. There's no, unless some outside influence like a collision that changes the momentum,
right.
It's going to stay the same.
What kept the particles together? How did they end up sticking together?
Okay, well, you know, again, you're talking about a question that is still open. But to begin with, what pulls them in is gravity. If you've got a bunch of particles that are spread out, the only force really by which they can pull themselves in is gravity.
Okay.
Things like magnetism and electricity don't really come into it. Once they get close together, then you can start getting chemical bonding. So, for example, if you get two particles of, say, graphite, a form of carbon, once they get close together, they can and they almost touch, then you can get a chemical bond, and those two things will stick together by chemistry rather than gravity. And then gravity will bring in more particles, and they'll stick together by chemistry. So eventually, you get a whole ball of rock that is bound together more on the chemical level than it is by gravity. But it's gravity that starts the whole thing off, and then it's chemistry that takes over once it gets, you know, really closely bound together.
So it's possible when Earth was forming, David, it could have been a real small little dinky planet, and then it got bigger and bigger and bigger, almost
basically,
like a snowball.
Yeah, kind of. You know, it pulls itself in, and to begin with, all of the material would have been sort of the same kind of, you know, icy, rocky mixture, and then gradually the heavier stuff sinks towards the center again by gravity. That's why we have an iron core to the planet, an iron nickel core. Those are the heaviest elements on Earth, and then as you move out from that, the stuff gets lighter and lighter until you get to the crust, and then you've got the lightest rocks of all. On the surface, and that's called differentiation. And you see that in all of the planets except the very smallest moons, where they don't have enough gravity to kind of settle out that way.
Who in the heck designed this?
Yeah, you're getting back to that question again. Well, you know, there's different ideas in there. There's the, if you like, the biblical idea that somebody is kind of you know, there's an overarching intelligence of God or something that sort of micromanages all this thing and says, you know, this is the way it's going to be, and I impose my will upon that. That's the way it's going to be. And then there's another sort of version of that that says there's an intelligence behind the universe that wrote the laws of physics and nature into the whole thing to begin with, so that that's the way it would turn out. And then you've got kind of the modern scientific view, which is that there's a whole bunch of universes out there, and different things happen in different universes. Sometimes it happens like the way it does in our universe, and in other cases, who knows what happens.
David, when we come back at the top of the hour, we will really get into the book Now We Are Not Alone as we talk about why we are not alone. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.